History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest enough time to patiently listen as memories which may have been buried for a long, long time start to emerge once more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from veterans who endured the kind of situations most of us can only imagine. As you know, over the years, we've focused almost exclusively on the World War II generation, but every once in a while, we make exceptions. And that's what we're going to do this week as we approach National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Today, you'll meet a man with a unique assignment in Vietnam who has spent all these decades since carrying a substantial burden that he's going to share with us today. This interview was recorded at VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida, where this weekend is their big military gala. Thanks to Loretta Forlaw for introducing me to Swift Boat veteran Rex Perry, who lives in the Orlando area now but grew up about 800 miles north of there.
I am from Logan, West Virginia. It was a small mining town. At the time I was growing up, it was probably 15, maybe 20,000 people, and now it's probably 8,000 people. My father was a coal miner. My mother was a housewife. I had three brothers and one sister. My sister was older than me, and I'm the oldest son, and I'm the only one left. I volunteered for Swift Boats because my brother had went in the Army, and they wouldn't send brothers in a war zone together. And 2 weeks after I got back, they sent him, and he spent a year over there. And 6 months after he got back, he committed suicide from PTSD. They didn't know what it was back then. But we had gone home. We lived in Massachusetts at the time. And we had gone home, and I seen him, and he was a mess.
Before we get to that, let's talk about hopefully happier times. I'm always fascinated by the stuff that preceded your military service, too. And you mentioned, you know, being the son of a coal miner there in West Virginia, which in recent years has become kind of a hot-button issue. And I'm sure that's why the population has changed in your hometown, too. But what was life like? What are some of the things you remember with your brothers and sister in those early years?
The mountains were fantastic. That was my playground. I used to hunt, fish, camp. Once you had a friend and where I lived in the community I lived, you had a friend for life. It was a wonderful life. It was a hard life for my dad. He died of black lung. It was a very hard life for him, but he provided for the family. We had all the love a family could want. My dad always said he never wanted his sons to go in a coal mine. And out of the four of us, I'm the only one that never went in the coal mines. My three brothers worked in a coal mine, and I kept his wish.
How did you end up in the Navy? How old were you, and what happened?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I went to college. I spent two semesters there, and I said, man, this ain't for me. I was 18 at the time. Well, I turned 19, and I dropped out. It really made my parents mad. And I went down. I didn't join the Army because I couldn't see getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and putting a backpack on and running 5 miles for breakfast. And I says, that ain't for me. And I checked the Marine Corps and the Air Force. And the Navy I checked, and the Navy has more schools than any other branch of service. Anything you want to do, the Navy has got a school for it. We had schools in Newport that Marines went to, that Army and Air Force went to. They came to our schools. So I chose the Navy. My first duty station was New London, Connecticut, after boot camp. I wanted to go into submarines, and this was right after the Thresher had went down. I got to school, and 3 weeks into school, they took us out on a submarine, and it was the old sewer pipe type. It wasn't a nuclear. And I got claustrophobia. So I dropped out. I couldn't handle the spaces. They asked me where I wanted to go, and I said, I want to go to Newport, Rhode Island. And they sent me to a tin can in Newport. My first cruise was to the Med. We came back, and then we went to Boston to the shipyard and had work done on the ship there. Spent about 3 months. I got in trouble with my mother at the time. It's the first time I'd been in a really big city, you know, Boston, and I was having a good old time. She got in touch with the Red Cross. The Red Cross got the number of the ship. She called the captain, and captain called me in and says, you know who I just talked to? I said, who? He says, your mother. Okay. And I was 20 at the time. He says, she said that you haven't written or called home in 3 months. I said, so? And he says, it ain't going to go so in my on my ship. He says, you will either call or write your mother once a month as long as I'm on this ship. I don't want to see no more phone calls from a mother. I said, well, Captain, I said, I'm 20 years old. I'm in the Navy. I can do what I want. He's not on my ship. So I ended up writing letters once a month. Yeah.
And what was that ship?
It was a destroyer, the USS Davis, DD-937. It was a Sherman-class ship. As a matter of fact, they've had one. It was a presidential ship. They have one in Washington on the Potomac. But I read here a few months ago that they were going to decommission it and turn it into razor blades. So it was a good ship. It was fairly new. It had a very good crew on it. We had some very good captains. The year before the ship went to Vietnam in 1966, we won the Arleigh Burke Award, which is the best ship in the Atlantic Fleet. When we started around the world, we went through the Panama Canal, and then we went to San Diego. And the ship that had won the award on the Pacific side was in port, and we swapped plaques because they give you a big plaque. And they had a little ceremony on that. And then we went, to Hawaii and the Philippines, then to Vietnam, doing some bombardment and plane guarding for the aircraft carriers. Went to Taiwan, Japan, Hong Kong, Australia, and then after we were cut loose to come on around the world, we went to India, one little country at the mouth of the Red Sea, and we stopped there and went through the Red Sea. I got a picture in here of what we went through. Went into the Mediterranean again and went to Greece and Italy, Spain, Mallorca, which is a small island off of Spain, and went to Gibraltar and went back to Newport. And anytime, we were gone for, 3 or 4 months, maybe 5. There is nothing like being on a ship, coming on the horizon, and seeing America. It is the most prettiest sight in the world. I always remember that. I always got up early in the morning because we usually docked around 8 o'clock. And I always got up about 5 o'clock, got a cup of coffee, went up on a torpedo deck and sat out there and watch it come up. But every time we went out, I did this. After we left the yards in Boston, we went to Guantanamo Bay for a shakedown to make sure everything was okay and everything. But that was that part of my life, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And what about your duties on that destroyer?
I stood sonar watches because the sonarman and torpedoman, their berthing space was together. I had to stand sonar watches with another sonarman. My duty was to keep the torpedo deck clean and make sure all the maintenance was done on the torpedo tubes and so forth. Then when we were in port, if I had the duty, a lot of times I had to stand quarterdeck watches and so forth.
And, you mentioned going to Vietnam and doing some bombardment and plane guarding out there. Was that an eye-opening experience for you? Because now all of a sudden you're in a war zone, and I don't know if that's what you signed up for, but now you're there.
It wasn't really an eye-opener because, we were 10 miles out. I had a crew on the number one gun. It was the 5-inch 54s, the big ones that set usually on the forecastle and on the fantail, and usually some of them, we had three, one set on top of the 01 deck. I had a crew that when we fired, down in the bottom of the ship was all the ammunition for that weapon. We were on the forward one. I had a crew that they would take the projectile, we'd put it in one place, and then take a container that held all the powder in it, slide it in, and then it went up and when it went into the gun, it pushed the projectile into, and they would fire. And sometimes when they would fire, the thing rotated. You filled it up, and then as it come around and was empty, you put another one in because you never knew how many they would fire. But when it went off, you felt it. It seemed like it would just shake. And I've been told that the battleships, as big as a battleship is, if they turned all those big guns to, say, starboard and fire them all at once, it would move that ship sideways in the water as big as it was. When we get back to Vietnam on the swift boat, we had an experience with one of them.
And I don't want to leave anything out about your tin can sailor life, if you have anything else to add there, but that was a big transition you made from a destroyer, which among ships is fairly small, to something a lot smaller than that.
The Davis was, I think, around 350 foot long. The swift boat was 50 foot long. The Davis had a crew of like 325. The swift boat had a crew of 6. So that was a big transition.
Well, and before we hear about it, I mean, I've got to ask this question because I've had so many veterans over the years, probably hundreds of them, tell me you never volunteer for anything in the military. But that sounds like a rule that you broke to get into swift boats.
It is. I don't say you don't volunteer for anything, maybe in the Army, but it didn't bother me to volunteer. It's a job that had to be done, and they need volunteers, I go.
And what was it about swift boats that caught your eye?
Excitement. I'd talked to a couple of the crews and everything, and it wasn't military. We wore cut-off dungarees, no T-shirts, no hats. We didn't salute. I mean, we used yes, sir, and no, sir, toward our boat officer. But he wore cut-off khakis, no T-shirt. I mean, it's too damn hot, you know. But just the excitement of it really caught my eye.
Well, I want to hear about it. And on your hat here, you're wearing the pin of Coastal Division 13 with the big black cat with its paws on a swift boat. Cat Low is where you guys were stationed. Give us an idea of some of the things you guys were assigned. What were you supposed to be doing over there?
Well, when I first got there, we patrolled the coast. We searched sandpans. There was thousands of them. We'd go alongside, and I was up in the forward gun tub, and I had a 12-gauge shotgun because the 50s wouldn't go down enough alongside that way, and I always had a 12-gauge pump shotgun. One guy would go, and sometimes two guys, according to how big it was, go aboard and take their papers and hand them to the boat officer. We would go through the boat checking for weapons, extra rice. If they had 50 pounds of rice, we knew that they were taking it to the VC because they only took enough to survive because they ate some of the fish that they caught and so forth. That was called market time. And then after about 3 months, we got the go-ahead to go into the rivers and start going up the rivers and patrolling the rivers in the Delta. We would get calls from the Army and the Marines and so forth that we need mortars. There's another story once we get on that.
Well, yeah, and maybe leading into that, you mentioned, you know, the gun tub up front, 50 calibers there. You're holding the shotgun for the stuff that can't reach, and then there's a mortar on the back of this 50-foot boat. Any other armaments that you guys were carrying?
We had the 81 mortar, the 350s. Sometimes we would have a 20-millimeter, and then we had 6 AR-15s. We had a 38 pistol, which a boat officer used. We had a M79 grenade launcher. And the shotgun, that was it. And the boat was made out of quarter-inch aluminum.
Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot of protection there. And for some people, those who are familiar with the swift boats, they have an idea of what your mission and your purpose was there. But others may not be familiar. So how did you understand your mission or your purpose for where you were?
I just followed orders, and they sent us on patrol. Cat Low was our main base. When we came out of the river, you could go north or you could go south. And we had a 20-mile sector that one boat patrolled. And then they had another boat in the next sector, and his was maybe 20 miles. And he would patrol that. Now, when you first got there and you got your boat, naturally, they send you to the farthest zone because it takes you longer to get in. And the guy that's in the first zone, he's due to go home within a month or so. So he's up front. And then once that boat leaves, the guy behind him, that's the way they worked us. We worked off of an LST when we went down south. We would take extra clothing, shaving gear. Our patrols were 24 hours on and 24 hours off. We were at the base. We still went on patrol. But when we came in and we had 24 hours off.
Well, and as far as explaining what you're looking for, you mentioned, you know, with the rice, if they had that much, their supply in the VC. You're looking for maybe actual enemy as well on some of these patrols?
It's been known that enemy's been on them and threw hand grenades. But basically, we were looking for extra food, weapons, and ammunition. And if their papers wasn't in order, then, you know, we could take them in or whatever.
I guess, you know, one thing that comes to mind as I try to imagine myself in your shoes is, what level of tension are you feeling as you carry out those duties? I mean, are you on constant alert for those 24 hours, wondering what's around the next bend? Or was it as calm and matter of fact as you kind of make it sound?
I'll just put it this way. I've been back 55 years, and my wife, when she wakes me up, she throws a shoe at me or something. I don't like fireworks. I hate New Year's. I hate when they put off fireworks. I go into my man cave at home and turn the TV up, take my hearing aids out. I can't stand them. The tension over there, it's according to how far you were out and everything. If you were half a mile out or so, you relax a little bit. But when you start going in the river, you're on alert. You're always looking and checking. I don't like anybody to come up behind me and say boo. I don't like that at all. My granddaughter, she has a very bad habit of it.
Well, that's one thing we won't do, but one thing we do need to do is take our first break. There's much more to come in this special edition of Hometown Heroes, preparing you for National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Find out about observances where you live and take that opportunity to thank the Vietnam vets in your life. When we come back, why one particular name on the wall in Washington, D.C. holds special meaning for Rex. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.